Hello, this is John Costa with my colleague Rob Watson on Spotlight and Art. How are you this week, Rob?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Cool. We always mention the weather, not quite as nice today.
It's a bit blustery outside, but it's blowing the cobwebs away. I mean, I enjoyed the nice weather we had the last couple of days.
It's quite nice, wasn't it? This morning it felt very personal. Me on my bike on Saffron Lane always feels like I've got my head into the wind. It's never with me coming down Saffron Lane. It's always against me. But there we go. So this week on Spotlight and Arts, we've got someone that we've both known for quite a while, actually, for lots of different reasons. Tim Grayson, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Thank you for joining us.
Well, you're welcome.
I'm really excited to talk to you, actually, this week. I mean, there's so many things that I could talk to you about in all the different disguises we've known each other over the years since we did Citizen's Eye and stuff. But I'm particularly looking forward to talking to you about your game and designing your game. But my first question I always ask people is, when was the first time you can remember doing something that you thought was creative?
Oh, wow. As far back as I can remember. I've always made stuff. I've got a frog in my throat already. But I've always made stuff, always. And maybe from the moment I could literally crawl around, I was building things and drawing. And I even drew much to my parents' delight, I'm sure, I drew a Christmas tree on the wall, I think when I was about 2 or 3 or something, which they kept up there for...
That's hooligan behaviour. That could have ended in a very different slippery slope, couldn't it? But yeah. It's interesting because your post that you put out yesterday on social media was about the, you know, what you'd like to do, and probably for the first time, and I think you did it at the weekend where you said, like, you changed your plans, you bought a train ticket and you went off somewhere where your ultimate vision is to 100% spend your time being creative and doing the things that you want to do. And I should imagine that's something that a lot of creatives or artists will be listening to this, and certainly the ones that Rob and I have interviewed since we started doing these recordings are very much where they're at. You know what I mean? So life and rent and being a parent and all that kind of gets in the way, but your ultimate aim is always to get to that. For most people, it's retirement, whereas you seem to have a plan. I mean, you share, being very honest about it, you know, different ups and downs and stuff, but you've got a plan, and it's more about just making the decision to go for it.
I think that's the thing. I mean, for the last over a decade, I've been in a very corporate role. You know, I work in publishing, and it's a great job. It would be someone's dream job, what I have, but it's not mine. I mean, I do it, and I'm very good at it. Which is why I've done it for as long as I do, and it helps me travel and do all that kind of stuff. And the thing is, it also gives me the money to support my creative ambitions on the side. But it's just got to the point now, I don't know, maybe it's my age now. I mean, I'm going to be 38 this year, and maybe it's that whole kind of approaching middle age thing. I don't know, maybe it's a midlife crisis. I don't know. But it's kind of got to the point where I'm just thinking, you know, I interview some amazing people as part of my day job, right? I do. And these people all create, and they do loads of amazing things, and they're really passionate about it. But the thing that's different, I guess, is that I still do similar kind of stuff to them, but, you know, in terms of creating, but I just relegate it to the sidelines. And I think I'm just getting to the point where I'm tired of relegating who I am to my spare time. I want to be doing it all the time. It's scary because obviously I need to make sure that I'm able to support the family and, you know, obviously pay the mortgage and all that kind of stuff. I need to make sure I'm doing all that. But at the same time, I'm just thinking that if I don't do it now, then when?
And for all the plans that you've got written down, or, you know, on the back of a fag packet, or sort of, you know, on the back of a postage stamp, or me, I'm always writing index cards. I've always got something on the go. Yeah, you can do all of that sort of stuff. And sometimes it's just making the decision that that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
And then working out what's the first step. So what was for you? Was it getting on the train over the weekend and just going off? And you said knocking on doors.
It's been pretty much a... over the last year, I would say, I've been kind of back and forth about what it is that I want, you know, because, like I said, I'm good at my job. I had a bit of a health thing last year as well, which may have made me see things in a slightly different way. That's probably definitely a driver, a bit of a health scare, but I'm okay now. So maybe that's a driver. And then at the weekend, I just thought, you know what? There's things that I can do. I had a weekend clear because usually I'm always with the kids. And yet this weekend, my wife took them down to her parents and I was like, right, I've got an entirely free weekend. And honestly, the first thing I thought of doing was I'm just going to sit and play a computer game for the entire day because I never get to do that. And then I just, and then in the morning, I saw a post by somebody that said it was an opportunity that I thought, right, okay, actually, it will cost me 50 quid to go down there and make the most of this. So I'll do it.
So Tim, what was the opportunity that you went off to?
Well, there's this there's a gentleman that has a social media thing called Simon Squibb. I don't know if you know about him, but he does loads of things where he basically just asks people, he stops people on the streets and just say, "What's your dream?" and sticks a camera in their face and asks them what their dream is. And I've been following him for a while. It's always been one of those inspiring things where I mainly followed him because it was amazing to see other people being given these opportunities, and even maybe not even the money or the doors or whatever that he opens for them, but just having people stop and actually consider what their dream actually is, like what they actually want to do,
and acknowledge that,
and acknowledging
in a positive way.
And sometimes he would say, "Well, if you don't know now, I'm going to have something to eat. So, you know, I'll be eating in your restaurant. Come back and see me, and if you think of one," and they'd come back and say, "Well, actually, I'm thinking of I've always wanted to do this," and that was just really inspiring. And I've been watching, like I said, for years. I've seen this and. It's just something that I've just watched as a bit of entertainment. But then when I saw that he was, you know, his book's been out and he's putting loads of his proceeds into funding these things and all this type of stuff. And I thought, well, I'm just going to do it and I'm going to ring on this doorbell. And I'm basically just going to, I'll pitch the fact that I want to do this 100% of my time. If he can open some doors in order for me to get it into the, you know, the big retailers, which is what I actually asked for. I didn't ask for any money. I just said, look, I just want some doors open so I can do it myself.
Not access and stuff. Because you often hear that on Dragon's Den, don't you? I remember watching it in the early days when it was either, it's, I'm going to invest in you, but also I'm going to introduce you to the right people that can get it where it needs to be.
That's exactly it. That's what I asked for. But then I know that there's going to be lots of other people. They're going all around the country and they're, you know, lots of people. So the thing is that nothing may come of it. But I think internally, I think something switched when I made that decision to not, you know, sit around and chill out and actually go and try and make something on my Saturday, which would usually be a day to chill out, right? Or to spend with family. I think something inside me switched and I just went, oh no, I want to be doing this. Why am I delaying it? Because, you know, obviously there's the game, but there's loads of other stuff that I've done as well. And it's just one of those things I just need to, give myself the time to be able to do it. So while I was down there, I did that thing. And then I thought, right, okay, well, I'm down here anyway. I know there's the Peace Pagoda down here. I know there's the Japanese temple. Obviously, it's a Japanese-inspired game. So I was like, right, I'll make the most of it. I'll go and take some photos there while I'm here, because then it's not a wasted trip. I mean, even if nothing comes from ringing that particular doorbell, then it's not a wasted trip. It becomes an opportunity.
Well, the thing is also, when you think, we always laugh, don't we, about New Year's resolutions, people are like, I'm going to get fit, blah, blah. And then it's like, you know, then there's always like some meme on social media of like the gym being absolutely crazy. So someone else goes somewhere else and they'll come back when all the sort of the people with their New Year's resolutions don't come anymore. And the gym goes back to where it normally is around about the end of January, you know. And it just seems a little bit more, what you said and what you did and what you've just said you went off and did seems a little bit more symbolic than deciding to go to a coffee shop and plan out what I'm going to do next. You actually not only the money, but you got on a train and you went somewhere and it was about doing something. Does it feel like a turning point to you now, a couple of days afterwards? You've had a few sleeps to kind of get it out of your system.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the fact that pretty much I did that and then, I mean, obviously that the actual act of it, it's such a minor thing, but for me, in terms of my headspace, it just made me go, like, what am I doing? So absolutely, you know, that's why I did that. I did something recently. We'll presumably talk about it maybe a bit later, but I've been doing things to try and generate more attention towards it, because ultimately it is what I want to do. Not necessarily selling it, but just making new stuff, you know, but spending 100% of my time making new things, producing those things, and then ultimately giving them to other people to sell. So then I can use that as passive income. So then I can carry on making stuff, because that's what makes me happy.
Now, what I find from doing these things with Rob talking to creatives is the fact also that it always seems when you talk to someone about something that they're doing it all the time and they're doing what you want to do. Whereas in fact, the reality of it is they're probably doing it part-time like you, and you're just talking to them and giving them all the attention, and then suddenly, you know, they've got other things to do and they work in a coffee shop and they've got job, you know, all that sort of stuff. So you're almost like you're fighting that, I can't do it because not everybody's doing it full-time. And then when you come across someone who genuinely does something, or actually I think who's genuinely creative, I think you are genuinely creative. And, you know, talking in the next section, I think, to you about your poetry and what you do at Beaver Castle, for me, that already classes as being something that's kind of, you know, uber creative. So you're listening to John Costa and Rob Watson on this week's Spotlight on Art. And I'm with an uber creative, I'm going to call him an uber creative, Tim Grayson. So Tim, talk to us a little bit about your poetry and being a poet in residence at Beaver Castle. I mean, for a lot of people, that would probably think that's already the coolest thing in the world. So, you know, why do you want to do a game? Just kind of calm down and just concentrate on doing that. Surely that's a nice environment to hang out in.
It is. I mean, obviously, even though the title is Poet in Residence, I don't live there. Like the Duchess of Rutland lives there with her family. I do stay there from time to time. I'm going over to stay in a few weeks to meet with guests and perform some of my poetry to them and to demonstrate Tatakai, my board game. It's genuinely, it came about, it was a chance thing. I worked together with the Duchess on our community project years ago, over 10 years ago now, small thing. And she heard my poetry as part of that and commissioned me to do a piece. So I wrote a piece for her, because obviously a Duchess asks you to do something, you're going to do it, right? just for the opportunity.
Like some people you just don't say no to.
Yeah, it's kind of like, well, I'll do it because this is, you know, when's this opportunity going to come around again? So I did it. And when I presented it to her, she loved it. She actually asked for it to be, she got someone to make a kind of professionally like written or calligraphed, is that the right word? Version of it to be done and framed, and then she had it exhibited at Christie's when she had her book launch. So there was all these kind of lords, ladies, celebrities, and people in this room, and I was invited as well. And then they had this professional orator perform my work to this room full of people and hearing my my work. It was incredible.
And sometimes that's more powerful than you being in that position, being able to do it, isn't it? I mean, that's great, but then hearing someone else do it, it kind of moves it to a different level.
It elevates it. And the thing that's, I guess, what screenwriters would feel when they see these incredible actors that perform their work, or, you know, it's a similar kind of thing. I guess that's the beauty of writing for other people to read it, because they can, especially other people who are skilled in that. I mean, I'm skilled in poetry, but I'm not necessarily skilled in performance, right? That's not one of my, I perform my stuff, but it wouldn't necessarily be a skill that I would say that I, you know, that I have as part of my arsenal. I obviously will as part of the process, but
if forced,
yeah, if I have to. But absolutely, there are, you know, when there's someone who makes a living, you know, being an orator, then it's, you know, and you hear your work being read out by this, it's incredible. But I've actually got a little anecdote of when I was there, as the Duchess introduced this man and said, "Oh, we're about to have a piece from our poet in residence performed to you." There was myself and my brother were standing there, and there were these two people in front of me, and these two people said, "Poet in residence." And they were kind of like just bit scathing,
dismissive,
about it, a bit dismissive. And then the man got up and he performed my work, And then as he was, as he kind of he closed the paper or whatever, everyone was clapping and the people in front went, that was bloody good, actually.
And then, vindication.
And then the Duchess came up on the stage and then said, and we actually have our poet in residence here tonight, and kind of like just
spotlight.
Put it onto me. And then the people in front turned around and there was this mixture of like just of like both terror and also like this admiration kind of, yeah. It was this weird moment.
Did he
like,
hear what we said?
Yeah, exactly. And then they were like, oh, that was wonderful. And I was like, oh, thanks. So, but yeah, it was an amusing moment.
Yeah, I mean, something like that is almost, you know, for some people, that's the ultimate, isn't it? That happens once and they kind of go about their day job and have lived their 15 minutes. But I mean, you've got like, you know, your game, which we can talk about now. I mean, you know, you're quite accomplished in sport as well.
Yeah,
I mean,
I'm actually wearing the you can't see it on the podcast, but I'm wearing a jumper from my gym. Yeah, so I own a club with a few other coaches, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu club. So I've been doing that for 15 years now. I used to train with Nathan Leverton of Leicester Street Fighters, and it got me to a certain point, and then, you know, train there for years, and then it's just the natural thing, isn't it, to then progress and do it yourself. And so now we have our own thing, and that's
And do you find that being healthy or participating in something like that is good for your creativity? Do you think they're matched? So we've just mentioned about your involvement in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, if I remember correctly. And that brings us on nicely, because obviously it's Spotlight and Art, so we can't spend too much time talking about sport, about your Tatakai game, which is all about tactics and assassins and emperors and stuff like that, which probably much sounds like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu to me. So is there a natural correlation between your game and the way that you approach your Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jiu-Jitsu originates in Japan, right? And then the reason why it's called Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is because they basically took certain parts of it, especially the ground parts, and I would say modernized it and really focused on those to make it far more effective than what it was. It's quite an archaic thing before. But yeah, I've always been intrigued by Japanese culture. It's always been something that I've loved. When I was younger, I was fascinated by it. I'm still fascinated by it now. At the at Beaver Castle, there's the Japanese woodland there, which is a project by the Duchess. It kind of made sense when I developed this. It was developed over lockdown, actually, as a way to keep the kids busy. That was basically the main reason why I did it. And then my wife, Kaz, she really enjoyed playing it herself. And then she was like, you know what? She was getting really competitive with it, right, with me. Not with the kids, but with me.
Mate, I played it yesterday with my mum twice, and she beat me both times, assassinated me, she told me. And I'm thinking, well, actually, she's a bit of a chess assassin as well. So the fact that she liked it, I thought was quite good. Cool. How did you come up with the original idea?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I love chess, and I love... but the thing with chess is that... I play bullet chess every single day. It's one of my... I would say vices, because I end up spending like my spare time doing it. It's just something that I love doing, and I get really competitive with that as well. But the thing is, if you try and play chess with a child, for example, there's always going to be that skill level difference. And unless you let them win, you know, you're always going to beat them. So that's why I like Risk, right? Because Risk has still got that strategy element, but at the same time, you've then got the luck of the dice roll. So you could potentially play Risk with a child and have the child win, even if you do all the best tactics. But the problem is that Risk takes forever to set up. And like I said, over lockdown, when I developed it, you know, I realized that you would set this whole thing up and then they'd lose interest after 10 or 15 minutes. So I kind of wanted to have it as like a really scaled back version of that, just something where you've got the strategy of like chess and Risk. And also you've got that luck element that Risk brings to it. So you could play it with the whole family. And that was kind of the reason why I did it. And like I said, when I created it, my wife got very competitive, and and she was the one that encouraged me to do it. She was like, no, you should probably do this. This should, you know, I've done a few other little board games before just to keep the kids busy. But with this one, she was like, no, this one I think should be good. So obviously registered the design, trademarked the name, all the kind of stuff I needed to do to protect myself. I just started making little copies to sell to my friends and family. And then kind of, you know.
This marvellous looking box that's here next to us now, you know what I mean, yeah. That you've got, which I'm sure people will see on the photographs. In your creative... I think you used the word arsenal earlier as well. Your creative cabinet of weaponry. Where does the game sit with your poetry, your Brazilian jiu-jitsu, your book about jiu-jitsu as well, you know what I mean? I mean, and all the things that you've done, I mean, where does that sit? Is it one of many, or is it something you're particularly proud of?
It's definitely something I'm particularly proud of. It's something which I think, because the fact that with poetry and with it's very you want it to be accessible to everybody, right? But at the same time, there are some people that are just never going to be interested in poetry. It's just part of life. Maybe, you know, maybe at a funeral or a wedding, they'll be interested in poetry. But outside of that, you know, these big momentous occasions, it doesn't really fit in. Whereas games, everyone likes games. Everyone likes to play. So the thing that that I love about it, and why I'm quite proud of it, is that, you know, I could pretty much describe the rules to anybody within a minute. And then we can play a game, and, you know, the majority of people are going to have fun, you know, unless they don't like games, obviously. But who doesn't like games? Most people will have fun. And you could literally play it, like, you know, with a child who's, like, you know, five, really. I'd say five is kind of the minimum age. And they'll get it right up until, elderly people. I played it with my granddad before he passed, and he loved it. And I'm really glad that I got to share it with him before he did pass as well, because he was very proud of me for it.
So I saw on social media that you put up this post, which was the people that buy the board game today by 5 o'clock, I'll match one that I'll go off and I'll give to an old people's home or a children's home or to a school and stuff. And that was great, because obviously you've sent and shared with me a photo of somewhere that you took the board game this morning, a sort of an elderly home this morning, which is pretty cool, actually. And I think that's, you know, there are still positive things that you can do with social media. It doesn't have to be negative. You can still encourage people to do things and be... do you find that quite challenging as a creative on how you use social media, or is it something that it comes naturally to you?
Well, so I'm diagnosed with ADHD. Okay, so like on my social media, I'll go through like stages where I'll post a lot, and then all of a sudden you won't hear from me for maybe like a couple of weeks or a week or so. And it's because...
I just thought you was creating another game. Sorry. All right, it's your ADHD. Okay.
Yeah. No, so it's one of those... Well, obviously, there is that as well. But the thing is, that's pretty much it, right? So when I'm concentrating on something, like, I'll concentrate on that one thing and I'll give it 100% of my attention. And then, you know, with social media, because it's not something that I see all the time, if I am creating something, or if I'm working, or if I'm doing something else, I just don't think about it. It almost just goes out of my brain until I'm suddenly like, oh, I better start promoting something again, or oh, there's something that I've got to say, or an announcement, or
that's the time. Or a friend contacts you, aren't you okay?
Yeah, or a friend, exactly, or that. Or, I mean, obviously, I still go on social media just to check what other people are doing. You know, it's part of my daily routine. Obviously, it's something we all do. We just scroll through and want to see what our friends are up to. So I still do that. But in terms of me actually posting stuff, I find that balance hard. But then... my brain's like a little bit like a rechargeable battery. Like, I go through these parts where I'm ultra productive, but then I also have like moments where, you know, like I say, like I might have a whole weekend or a week or whatever where I just feel really sluggish and not really able to function very well, and then, you know, and then all of a sudden I'll be ultra productive again. And I feel like since I've come to accept that about myself and realize that that's just the way my brain's wired, I've just been a lot more forgiving, and I don't have any more shame about it. But I used to be really I was ashamed, because I would think, oh, what's wrong with me? Why some people seem to be able to just maintain consistency over a long period of time, and they can do something like they're happy to do the same post every single day or the same thing every single day. You know, it doesn't matter how many things that I set up to try and do that, it's just not going to happen. But obviously I've managed to create workarounds, and I've managed to create ways of being able to function without that. And part of it is just being accepting of the fact that my brain might be a little bit, you know, wired a little bit differently from other people.
Now, a lot of creatives that I've met doing this, and that I know generally over, you know, the last 20 years, and sort of doing things with Rob as well, and also teaching at the university with Rob, is that some of the most creative people I know also make sure they take the time to follow other people that are creative. Now, whether that's listening to a podcast or music or reading, you know, quite proactively, is there anybody who's your kind of go-to inspiration person? Okay, so it's more about whoever you see at that particular time and stuff.
So my whole thing, right, in my life, I have an ethos, and that is that whenever you achieve a position of power or a position of influence, you should always use that to help bring other people up with you, right? So everything that you, if you achieve something like with the castle, for example, I started a prize with that to then be able to help other creatives, other writers specifically, and in encourage them to write more poetry at local universities. I started the Leicester Literary Review mainly to encourage more people to give people, local people, but people everywhere, a platform to have their work published. You know, lots of people get lots of rejections, but at the same time, I was like, right, well, if it's good, if I can see that there's merit to it, then I'll try and make a platform that I can publish it. So there are so many people out there, and the thing is, I just want to make sure, especially creative people, I want to make sure that I'm using whatever position of power that I can, or whatever position of influence that I have, to be able to assist them as and when possible. So there are so many people that are doing amazing things, I don't want to like name anyone. But there are genuinely, there's so many out there.
But you take time out to seek out people.
Yeah, absolutely.
To be inspired by.
Yeah, to be inspired by, and also to help them as well. Like I just like making sure that I feel like this is one kind of big creative community, and where when we look after each other, I feel like that's when things grow.
So Tim, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today on Spotlight on Art. My final thing is, now that you're going 100% to sort of do these things full time, does that include for you, and Rob and I have this conversation all the time, does that include you spending 100% of your time doing the things that you want to do? And does that involve you having a space? So, you know, like, you know, the city's full of empty shops at the moment and stuff, you know, is the Tim Grayson hub of creativity, is that included in that, where you can help other people, or do you see it very much being behind the scenes, sort of digital, online, and then going out and being involved in things?
I think ultimately one day it would be great to have a space, but mainly the space would be a space to do I guess multiple different things. It would be more just like a, like if you imagine like a Da Vinci workshop with it, it's like all different things. You've got inventions, you've got, you know, paintings, you've got writing. That's kind of my ideal place. And not just for me either, because obviously when these, you know, when Renaissance masters or whatever, when they would be doing these things, often they would have people who would, you know, that they would mentor and, you know, that they would be able to bring up. I kind of want that for, not just for Leicester, I want that for the UK, I want that for the world, really. I essentially want to bring around not just me, but I think that you know, enough people could potentially bring around some kind of I don't know, I think everything's right for maybe like a new renaissance when it comes to creativity, just because there's so much, especially if I'm talking Leicestershire, there's so much creativity here, so many people here that are doing so many great things. And I just think that, you know, once everybody's like connected up and doing this cool stuff and thinking bigger, I think that my dream really would be that years from now, people would be able to look back to Leicester and be like, that was like the hub of this, like some kind of renaissance for the arts.
Now, Rob, we've had this conversation, haven't we, many times about spaces in Leicester and, you know, are they as creative as they claim to be, or are they as connected, or, you know, as they claim to be as well? So we've always talk about, you know, that space would be great, and we always talk about like filling it with like lots of mismatched furniture and donations from different people. We need those hubs that are not just named and owned by particular individuals or groups. We need stuff where it can just happen organically, don't we?
I think we're at a turning point in many ways with kind of culture and arts, and we're seeing the stifling influence of managerialism and technocratic administration of the arts has pulled us away from spaces of creativity, invention, intuition, those kind of things. And I think we need to think differently and look at, and you, I mean, there is some really good work, and Leicester is a good, could be potentially a really exciting test bed for this. But there, you know, there's good work that goes on, but it's kind of fragmented and disparate.
And it's also making sure that it has a platform that values that and gives it a voice, a bit like we're trying to use the, you know, the voice of Saw Sound to be a respected communication tool in community media, not just the usual suspect.
I think it's almost, we've got to go back to first principles, and we've got to say, you know, you need an empty room. Don't have an art gallery, don't have a performance space, have an empty room, and then let people walk in there and say, what can we do with this space? You know, and you know, and let that come from people's imagination rather than saying, because you can only get funding for it if it's X. You can only get funding for it. You can only develop an audience if it's Y. And it's like they're preconceived ideas. And I'm really interested in the idea of, let's use radio as a creative medium. Let's use other platforms as creative mediums and see where, you know, games, see where we can take them rather than trying to constantly. I mean, it's not to say that we forget the value and the virtues of past creative heritage, but what we also need those spaces where they're opened up.
So Tim, just to finish off, can I use a bit of poetry on you?
Yeah.
Long may ye be creative.
Thank you.
We go. How was that? Good. Thanks for coming on. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you.
What's next? 30 seconds. What's next for you?
What's next? This weekend coming up, I'm going to be at Beaver Castle. I'm going to be meeting guests and demonstrating Tatakai and doing private performances there. I've also got loads of other stuff coming up. I'm going to be at the UK Games Expo in May, where I've got a stall, not a stall, like a stand thing for Tatakai there. So that will be quite cool.
I think it's an exhibit. You need to start using big words. Exhibit. Like exhibition stand. You
know? Yeah, yeah, that's probably better. Start exhibition talking it stand. Up, yeah. Stall sounds a little bit tiny, doesn't it? But yeah.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Tim.
Thank you.